I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. It is a really great book out now from one of Canada's preeminent and best-selling historians. The Massey Murder, A Maid, Her Master, and the Trial That Shocked the Country is the latest from Charlotte Gray, who joins me now. It's February 1915, and a member of one of Canada's more prominent families is shot outside of his Toronto home. Bert Massey dies, and an 18-year-old domestic servant, Carrie Davies, confesses, thus beginning a sensational trial. The Great War is going on, yet the trial gets a lot of attention from the Canadian public. The book provides great insights into what Canada was like in 1915, the sort of social culture in Canada's largest city, as well as the politics of the era, thanks to the media and the establishment of the day. It's a compelling read and foretells what will soon happen in the country, chiefly what is to come with regards to the role of women in Canadian society. Charlotte Gray is an award-winning author and historian who is also a member of the Order of Canada. Her previous books include Mrs. King, Flint and Feather, Canada, A Portrait in Letters, The Museum Called Canada, Reluctant Genius, Nellie McClung, and Gold Diggers, which was her last book, a critical and best-selling hit, soon to be a miniseries on the Discovery Channel. Visit charlottegray.ca for more information. This new book is published by HarperCollins. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Kingston, Ontario today, Charlotte Gray. Ms. Gray, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, when we hear the name Massey, we think of, if you're in Toronto, the Massey's all over the place. You got Massey Hall and buildings named after them. If you are in this part of the country, you think of, say, Vincent Massey. I guess he was the first Canadian-born governor general, right?
That's right.
And then you go back a little further, Massey Ferguson. That's the family, right?
Yes, and in 1915, that Massey name was absolutely huge because the Masseys had the largest agricultural implement manufacturing plant in the British Empire, and supplied all the tractors and the harvesters right across the prairies, right across Canada.
And so in Toronto, I guess they were a pretty big deal. They were a member of the establishment, right?
Absolutely. By 1915, they'd merged with their main rival, and it was Massey Harris. And they were still very powerful and a very wealthy family, and a Methodist family, so that they were quite different. In fact, they were the new entrepreneurial class that was driving a lot of the economic development of Canada in that period.
And so where was Bert in the whole Massey milieu? He had a job, right? He was a car salesman, is that right?
Yes, poor Bert, who was shot on his own doorstep on Monday, the 8th of February. He was actually from a sort of branch of the family that had been elbowed aside. He was a grandson of the great family patriarch, Hart Massey, and his first cousin was Vincent Massey, who you've mentioned, who became Governor General later. But Bert Massey was from a branch that had been shouldered aside because his father, who was Hart Massey's eldest son, had died very young, and Hart Massey didn't want to dilute the ownership of his company. So he had just quietly disowned his daughter-in-law and her children. Bert Massey had the name Massey, but he didn't have any of the money, and he wasn't even working in the family firm. He was a Studebaker salesman.
Now, my most recent reference to life in 1915, I guess, would be Downton Abbey. Was Toronto in 1915 like that?
Nothing like as grand.
No.
I mean, I suspect many of the families would like to think they were the equivalent of Downton Abbey, but not a chance. And one of the reasons I wanted to look at this whole story was that the young woman who shot the fatal shot was a servant, was a 18-year-old English servant, Carrie Davis, who'd worked for the Masseys for 2 years. But, you know, when we think of servants in that period, we're likely to think about Downton Abbey and to think of this sort of whole world behind the green baize door, which is very comfortable and its own little sort of fairly privileged group. Well, it wasn't like that for Carrie at all. She was the only servant in Bert Massey's household. Her days would have begun at 5 o'clock in the morning and gone till at least 9 o'clock at night. She was working very, very hard, and she was all alone in the kitchen.
And what was her relationship like with Bert Massey and Bert's wife?
Why did she shoot him? Well, her relationship, in fact, had been good for the 2 years that she'd worked for them so far. She herself said to the policeman when he came and arrested her after she'd shot Bert, they always treated me well, but then he tried to ruin me.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened was that Bert Massey's wife had gone away, Rhoda, and it doesn't appear to have been a very happy family. There were hints through everything I read that, in fact, Bert was a bit of a philanderer. And his wife had left about a week earlier, and he'd had a party at which Carrie had done all the serving and all the cooking, and there'd been a lot of alcohol consumed. And a couple of days later, he tried to kiss Carrie. Now, she just pushed him away, and then she ran out of the house. And she came back, in fact, after she'd taken refuge with her sister that afternoon. But she'd known that, in fact, he'd had a bit of a hangover. He'd been he probably thought that he was just being playful.
Uh-huh.
Nonetheless, she went back to the house, and it was 2 days later when he's walking up the front path of his house and up the steps. She opens the door and shoots him in cold blood.
It was his gun?
With his gun.
Yeah. In reading the book, I was kind of curious because you talk about this book as being a departure from your previous books and the sort of people that you write about. Where do you encounter someone like Carrie Davies? Like, where was the first time that you sort of read about her or saw her?
Well, I've always been curious about the people our history books leave out. I've always been curious about the people who did not sort of leave monuments like Sir John A. and Confederation, or the generals during the First World War, the Mackenzie King, and the implementation of social programs in Canada. Those people are important in our history, but they've been written about so much. I've always wondered, what about the people who never leave a trace? What about all the people who were here and did contribute to the community in one way or another, but who vanished? And in fact, you can really never get at somebody in the position of Carrie Davies, because she never wrote diaries or letters or any of the primary material that a biographer needs to do a biography where you get inside the individual. But because of this legal case, because of that act in February 1915, I was able to actually investigate her life, because she does suddenly appear in the open. She appears in police court, and there are newspaper accounts of what she looked like. She appears at the coroner's court, and there are the court records. There are police records. I can hear her voice once or twice in interviews with, first of all, the police, and then with the Toronto Star at the after the trial. And finally, I could actually investigate the life of somebody who normally is invisible.
And do you find her likable?
You know, that's a difficult question. With the other people I've written about, whether it was Pauline Johnson or the various people who rushed to the Gold Rush, or Alexander Graham Bell, I had so much material about them because of letters and memoirs and diaries that I was able to actually get to know them and know what they were thinking, know what they were doing, know how they reacted to events and people, because I could read their own words. With Carrie, I couldn't, because I had glimpses of her, as I've mentioned, and I heard her voice once or twice, but generally I'm always seeing her through other people's eyes, how she's reported in the newspapers and everything. Likeable? She was a very timid, unadventurous, rather... she certainly wasn't insane, and she certainly wasn't simple-minded, but she was just very young. She was only 18, and she was a young 18-year-old. And she's, I think, well-meaning, but she was relatively unformed in many ways.
And she was born in England and then comes here, is that right?
Yes, she was born in England, the daughter of a soldier from the British Army, who died when she was quite young. Very large family. Her mother couldn't afford to keep her in school. She was put into service very young and was a domestic servant in various households in Britain before she came to Canada. Her sister had already come to Canada and paid for Carrie to come over. And in fact, Carrie remained very close to her family, and although she was paid a pittance by the Massey family, because domestic servants weren't paid very much, she saved as much as she could and was always sending it back to her very impoverished mother back in England, who was still trying to raise the younger children.
What was the makeup in terms of, say, ethnicities in Toronto in 1915? Were there a lot of Brits?
Yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is what I found so fascinating about this case and why I wanted to write about this case, because of the period in which it happened. Canada at this stage, we're still less than 50 years away from Confederation, but the country is growing so rapidly. The population of Canada had increased by a third just in the first decade of the 20th century. And Toronto had doubled in population. Now, that's a very, very destabilizing population explosion for the country to absorb. And at the same time, Canada was still sort of, many people thought of the Britain as the mother country, and they thought of themselves as primarily British because most of the immigrants did come from Britain. But there were people beginning to come from other areas in Europe. Particularly, there were Jews coming from Central Europe, there were Italians, there were Irish Catholics who were challenging the balance. And out west, of course, there were a large Chinese section of the population. Canada was beginning to look very different from Britain. But Toronto, particularly, had a fairly rigid class system. And the old elite of Toronto really resented the newcomers. And that was part of the story, because many of the newcomers who were British, and Toronto was still 85% British in character, many of the newcomers challenged that old elite. And they did want a different kind of Canada. They wanted a kind of Canada where toffs, as the Brits would call them, like Bert Massey, who had a diamond tie-pin and belonged to such a wealthy family, couldn't harass 18-year-old servants. They wanted a different kind of Canada.
And in the media landscape of 1915, that plays a part in all of this. There were 6 newspapers in Toronto at the time, is that right?
Yes, it's incredible to think of it. The population was nearly 500,000. The combined circulation of the newspapers was nearly 500,000, because most households took 2 papers, one morning, one evening, and that was the only source of information. You know, this is a period when there's no radio, no television, no live streaming, no internet, no alternative source other than just sheer gossip.
Yeah.
And what was brilliant for me as the writer was that 2 of the newspapers, the Toronto Star and the Evening Telegram, were in a circulation battle, and they saw this juicy murder case as a fabulous way to win readers. The more lurid the details they could get, the more people would buy their newspaper at the street corner. So they covered the whole case really extensively, and I was able to read the clippings.
And then they take sides in the case, is that right?
It's incredible, you know. I mean, if you want to know about media spin, you look at this case. Here's this 18-year-old English immigrant, and she walks into the courtroom, and the court reporters are scribbling and drawing conclusions about her. And the Evening Telegram, which is a blue-collar paper that's very much on her side, describes her as a small, pale girl, very English, who looks like a Sunday school pupil. The Toronto Star, who decides that actually she is a murderer and that poor Bert Massey is the victim in this case, the Toronto Star describes her as having a Slavic jut to her brow and a mouth that suggests resentment. They read her face completely differently according to their bias.
And it's interesting to see how those papers progressed as the years went on, from then on.
Yes, and it's also strange because actually the Evening Telegram was the newspaper for those who were sort of most loyal to the British Empire and most determined to keep Toronto a British citizen, a British city, and it's the Evening Telegram that collapses. And the Toronto Star, which doesn't come out of this story terribly well, is the newspaper that has survived and that actually was quite progressive from its foundation. It always endorsed a more multicultural, more multilingual city and welcomed newcomers. It was more progressive than the Telegram, but I think it was in a really difficult position on the Massey murder case because one of the Masseys had put money into the newspaper and it had a residual loyalty.
Now Harley Duart, he's Davies's lawyer. I guess he was a prominent lawyer in Toronto of the day, right?
Yes, he was a prominent lawyer and he was a prominent liberal, and everybody knew Hartley Duart. He was very successful. And, you know, there weren't that many lawyers in Toronto in this period, and they were all making money hand over fist because they all had big institutional clients, the banks, the insurance companies, the railroad companies, and they were doing extremely well, thank you, especially the firms that were sort of full of upper-class family lawyers.
Was he in politics yet at the time? Or?
He had run unsuccessfully twice to be a Liberal MP, but he had not managed to win his seat. And he was, in fact, his career did not go as brilliantly as everybody expected when he first graduated from Osgoode Hall. He seemed to be such a suave, dapper, successful man. But actually, he although he was very clever, he just somehow never made it. And there were lots of rumors in the newspaper and in Mackenzie King's diary, which I read, suggesting that he was a little too fond of the bottle.
But he saw this case and defending her, and I guess the sort of profile that he'd get from representing her in this case, as a chance to raise his profile and perhaps parlay that into political success later on. I mean, is that what happened later on?
Well, I think he was determined to win this case, that he was going to be a hero to the Toronto working class. He was going to be a hero within his profession, and he was also going to settle an old score with the Massey family because his father and Hart Massey, Bert Massey's grandfather, had a clash in the late 19th century, and he had never forgiven Hart Massey for dragging his father, Hartley Duart's father, his name through the mud. So he had many scores to settle. He had a grudge, and he thought this was going to make his name. It didn't. And it didn't because, although he was successful, he had other problems that meant that he was never elected to the House of Commons, and he never really fulfilled his promise.
Now, the other interesting thing in this book, and I think what's fascinating, is how women are perceived in society in Canada in 1915. This trial doesn't really change very much, but later on we see, I mean, when we read the book, we sort of see what's to come. I mean, was there very much influence as to how women were perceived in society after this trial? I mean, did anything change?
The legal case itself did not change the law. The legal case itself, you know, was not quoted as a precedent in legal journals because the verdict, the outcome, was both a surprise and also not really in accordance with Canadian law at that time. But what it did do was sort of give people a glimpse of a Canada where there was more gender equality. And it also helped galvanize opinion. 1915 was such a crucial period in the emergence of articulate spokespeople for the women's movement. This is a period when the suffragettes were pressing more and more forcefully to get the vote. It's also a period in Canadian history where women's organizations, particularly the National Council of Women, are getting stronger and stronger. And because of the war, which of course is the backcloth against which this case is set, and all the young men streaming off to military training camps and then to the trenches, there are more and more opportunities for women to go into paid employment outside the home. And so this case was just sort of one more, it was a straw in the wind in terms of women making their voices heard and being thought of as something other than chattels. And also it was an opportunity for women to realize that they had battles to fight where they needed to engender some solidarity among themselves.
This is such a fascinating book to read. I mean, I stayed up with it a couple of nights and couldn't put it down. Did you enjoy writing it?
I loved writing it, actually, yeah. Because it really was a treasure hunt. It was a challenge to find the information I wanted because I'm writing social history, and for too long in this country we've concentrated exclusively on political and military history in terms of writing books that are going to be accessible to a wide audience. There just hasn't been a lot of social history, and so I was sort of thrashing around trying to find what it was like to be a servant in 1915, or exactly, you know, I knew Carrie had a boyfriend who disappeared to war in the previous fall. I wanted to find out more about him. It was also fascinating because I could walk around Toronto and see many of the buildings that had actually figured in the story, because they're still there. And of course, it's always wonderful to look up and see a building that you know has seen a century of civic life.
I Googled the house the other day on...
did you? How did you get on?
I found it. It was, what's the name? 149...
169 Walmer Road.
Yeah.
In fact, when I was doing the book, I walked down Walmer Road and knocked on the door, and a woman came to the door, and I explained I was writing this book, and she said, "Oh, did you come about the murder?" And I said, "Oh, you know all about it." And she said, "Yes, there was somebody here the other day asking about it." But the house is now divided into three apartments, and so I saw the main floor, but actually the layout of the house has changed quite dramatically since Carrie lived there.
Now, at the beginning of the book, you talk about this, you describe, I should say, the walk that Bert Massey takes from work, coming home from work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a first note I made when I was taking notes after reading the book. And you say that he had to sort of navigate through dog crap and snow.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, as the writer, how do you know what's on the street in February 1915?
Well, it's old photographs. I spent a lot of time looking at old photographs. So in 1915, they did clear the streets, but they didn't cart the snow away. And then I knew exactly what the house looked like, and I knew that, in fact, they had blocked gutters because of a photograph in the newspaper which shows the huge icicles hanging off the roof. But as a nonfiction writer, you know, you can't make these details up, but you can really get a lot from old photographs. When I did a book about Pauline Johnson, I spent a lot of time at Vancouver Public Library, which has a fabulous photographic collection, looking at the photographs of Vancouver. And I'm just being amazed. In 1908, you know, there were tree trunks in the middle of the main streets in Vancouver.
Yeah. What are you working on now?
I haven't decided.
But I follow you on Twitter and on Facebook, and I notice that you've been going up north. I guess that's part of the gold diggers shoot?
Yes. I went to the set of... You mentioned that U.S. Discovery Channel is doing a miniseries based on gold diggers, so I went to the set to watch them filming that, and that was a real buzz because the film company has recreated that wonderful photograph, the Hegg photograph of the Chilkoot Pass up in Yukon. They actually recreated that on a mountain in Alberta, and I was there watching all these poor extras in wool clothes. I mean, this is, you know, they would have died and gone to heaven if they'd been able to get to Mountain Equipment Co-op, but in 1896 they're wearing wool clothes, which the wetter they get, the heavier they get, and they were tramping up this mountain. It was quite extraordinary to watch.
This has been such a great pleasure to talk to you today, because I've enjoyed this book as the others of yours that I've read. All good wishes for this book.
Thank you so much, and it's great to talk to you.
The website for more, charlottegray.ca. The book is called The Massey Murder, A Maid, Her Master, and the Trial That Shocked the Country. Do pick it up. It's just a fascinating read. It's published by HarperCollins. It's author Charlotte Gray. Join me on the line from Kingston, Ontario. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plantin.